Okay. Let me remind you what we stopped last time. I gave a sort of discussion about this result, but let me remind you briefly. What we would like to solve is what is called the tensor tomography problem. In general, we would like to solve it for an arbitrary, compact, simple manifold, but so far we can only do it for surfaces. The statement is something like this. You give yourself a symmetric M tensor, and remember here I'm going to sort of move freely from the tensor to the function on SM. If I have a tensor, I can restrict it to, I can think of it as a function also from SM into R, in which the only thing you do is, for each point x on M, the tensor is a sort of multilinear form, has M entries, and you just pick all those M entries to be all V M times. Okay, so then I have a function in SM, and I can do the X-ray transform of that function, which is just simply you integrate along, if you have a point x, V, a point at the boundary x, and V pointing inside, you just integrate along the geodesic starting at that point. So this is the explicit formula for the X-ray transform. So the claim is that if you have a symmetric M tensor whose X-ray transform is zero, then the tensor must be what is called a potential tensor. Namely, there is another M minus one symmetric tensor, which vanishes on the boundary such that the F is this derivative of this tensor, which meant, let me just remind you that this D meant symmetrization and then Kavarian derivative of the tensor. Okay, sometimes I actually forgot to mention this, although I'm not going to use it in any way, but there is if you give any tensor can be decomposed. There is what is called a potential solenoidal decomposition. Decomposition of a tensor, which says that any symmetric tensor can be decomposed as a potential part. Be consistent, dH plus a solenoidal part, with the H vanishing on the boundary. And this FS has the property that the divergence of SS is equal to zero. So zero divergence, which I don't need to define here because I'm not going to use it at all. But this FS is called the potential part, sorry, the solenoidal part, because it has zero divergence, and this H is called, this dH is called the potential part. And there is a unique decomposition in this way. So another way to see this theorem is to say that if you have a symmetric M tensor that is equal to zero, then it's purely potential, or if you like, the X-ray transform is injective on solenoidal tensors. Yeah, so this is sometimes called S-injectivity. So we are actually proving, what we are proving here is what is called S-injectivity of I, dS coming from solenoidal. Okay, it's just a rephrasing really, that I'm not going to use in any way. Okay, so what's the idea to prove this? Let's begin with a proof. Symmetrize the del, symmetrize the del. No, we, well, no and yes. I mean, it's formally, it's the formal adjoint of D. Okay. So, yeah. So. Okay, so the proof goes along the following line. I mean, this is the sort of beginning of the proof has been around for ages. Yeah? So you convert this issue of being, you know, in the kernel of the X-ray transform into a transport equation, which we have already done. So you define the function uxv as the integral, I mean virtually, by the, it's virtually the same formula, but now you let the point xv now be an arbitrary point in SM. Yeah, so you define u in this way, and then just the fundamental theorem of calculus tells you that x of u is minus f, which as always, x is the geodesic vector field. Okay? And the, this is always true, the additional bit of information that you have, the important bit, is now that the function u now vanishes on the entire boundary of the unit circle bundle. Yeah? So this is the information. So, I mean, with the x-ray transform, the information you have, the way I set things up, is that the u is actually zero on delta minus, because it begins there, basically. Well, sorry. So if you define this like this, then at delta minus the time is zero, because, you know, you don't have to move anymore. So u vanishing on delta minus comes for free. The whole point about, you know, x-ray transform being equal to zero is precisely that this is because the x-ray transform is zero. Okay, and I pointed out to you last time that whenever you have a solution to a transport equation vanishing completely on the boundary, there is a regularity result that asserts, which I mentioned it, but I did not comment, and I'm not going to prove that in fact the function u ends up being an infinity function. So the possible issues of non-regularity that you may have on tangent vectors at the boundaries will go away if the IEF is equal to zero. That's right. The main difference right. Yeah, the sort of trade-off. So basically, that's a very good point, David. Thanks. So basically, before we were doing, well, we were looking at this in the case of systems with an attenuation, and my F was just of degree 0 and 1. And precisely the information that I'm given now, thanks for that, because that was the next thing that I was going to say, is precisely that the F now, is, since it is a symmetric and tensor, you can write it in Fourier modes like that. So it's a polynomial of degree n. Okay? This is because f is a symmetric n tensor. That's right. So this is what has changed somehow. So now I have more Fourier coefficients, but always a finite polynomial in the velocities, essentially. The regularity what? What is the question about the regularity? Not really, is the answer. No. Not completely. I mean, it uses a non... is essentially sort of, again, goes back to sort of Pestov and Ullmann, which they do some differential topology analysis of faults at the boundary. It's not obvious, but this is what I would say. So it would take you some time to really explain it properly. It uses the strict convexity at the boundary and so on. So, yeah, that's the answer, yes. No, not really. It's just the convexity at the boundary. So this would still hold for a sort of convex non-trapping, as Nico was indicating. Sorry? Tau of x v. Yes. What's a? It's non-trapping. Yeah. So yes. So non-trapping and strictly convex boundaries is still the same sort of regularity result. Yes. Okay. So really, then the goal is to show that in fact u has degree n minus 1. So this is the key. So if you show that the solution to the transport equation, so if f, this comes with a degree n in Fourier modes, if you show that the expansion of u has degree n minus 1, so namely by this I mean I want to show that uk are all 0 for k greater than or equal than n, then you're basically done, because the u becomes essentially your h. It gives you something of degree n minus 1, and you can easily convert that into a symmetric n minus 1 tensor. Okay? So I'm not going to go into the details of that. That's just algebra. But this is really the thing, to show that this u has degree n minus 1. And this has been known for a long time. That's the whole point somehow. In fact, All this that I have just said, I haven't said anything new that, I mean, wasn't known before this term. Yes, it is. Even is enough to show that U has finite degree. A finite polynomial will do. Once you have finite polynomial, then there are arguments that will show you that the correct degree is n minus 1. So you really need somehow to truncate the Fourier series of the U, which in principle you don't, just by that sort of definition. You have, you know, the way it is defined. That's usually the whole issue. Yeah, you come to a solution to the transport equation, and you need some understanding. That has been the whole point, in a way. You need some understanding on the dependence of this function u on the velocity entry. Okay, so that's really the goal. So, and if you remember, in the previous sort of couple of lectures when I was discussing the case of the attenuated transform, in the case of a function plus a one form, the whole goal was to show that this u was of degree zero. Yeah, that only u zero survived. Okay, so that's, so this is just generalization of that. Okay, so how do we do that? What's the idea? Well, this is a sort of, well, it is a little bit kind of crazy in a way. So we have a transport equation which is unattenuated. So the way to kind of deal with this is going to be to attenuate it. Yeah. So the idea will be to attenuate the transport equation. But you have to do it in a clever way. Okay, there actually, this, you know, actually twice as surprising. There's more than one way to do this. Okay, so I'm just going to show you one that I mean that's even perhaps the most efficient way. And this is like this. You consider, suppose that you can construct the follow a function. Suppose that you can take a function r that belongs to omega m. So remember, this omega m was smooth functions. Smooth functions of degree m, yeah. So if you like the vertical, if you apply the vertical vector field to R, you get im R. Suppose you take a function like that, and you define a connection. In this case, it's going to be all scalar, yeah. So it's not going to be in systems. I'm going to attenuate with a connection, but it's going to be a one by one connection. Suppose I define a connection by considering, defining it as minus R inverse XR. So, and the R is non-vanishing. Suppose this for a moment, and I will show you how to run the proof. And then I come back to this point and explain my choices of R and A. Okay? But suppose that this defines a connection. Or a one form. Yeah, so I would need this to be of degree one, basically. Without zero component. Suppose that for a moment. Then, the idea is just to know that RU now solves the following equation. If you differentiate XRU, you get, well, of course, XRU plus RXU. Yeah? And so rewrite in the same equation. So you see, in some sense, this R is a special integrating factor of A. So then XR is minus ARU, and then plus R times minus F, if XU is minus F, and therefore, X plus A, RU equals minus RF. Still having the function ru vanishing on the boundary, because if u vanishes on the boundary, r times u also vanishes on the boundary. What's the point of doing this? Well, the point is that, you see, f has degree m. So it has, you know, f minus m, f minus m minus 1, f 0, and then going all the way up. So if I multiply it by something of degree m, I shift all the polynomial up. So now this guy, Rf, becomes holomorphic. Okay? Because I shift it up, so everything that I have in negative degree, I move it up by multiplying it by r. Okay? Right. That's great. Now, we have that holomorphic, but we have that connection there, but now we can sort of gauge it away with the holomorphic integrating factor now. We attenuate it, and now we somehow, we disattenuate it. Yeah, so I now choose omega. Holomorphic, such that x omega equals, is it a or minus a? Let's just get it right. A. Yes, remember, I proved this last time, so proposition from last time. Okay. So now, the function, if you differentiate now, e to the omega r u, that equals minus e to the omega r f. Yeah? Still with the condition e omega r u vanishing on the boundary. Yeah. And again, this is true because if you differentiate, you know what happens with that one, and you know that this is an integrating factor. Yeah, so I attenuated first with this r, and then I disattenuated again. Okay? But keeping this right-hand side holomorphic. Okay. And now, once you have it in that shape, you prove a proposition, which is not difficult at all, given the sort of technology that we have developed. So you prove, this is a completely general proposition that says, this is somehow, as you'll see, I'll explain this one, this is not that hard. It says that if you have a simple surface, and f holomorphic, and suppose that you have a solution of the unattenuated transport equation, vanishing on the boundary, then u is holomorphic. And moreover, u0 is equal to 0. Okay, I will prove this in a minute. This is essentially follows by taking, again, the bracket with Hilbert transform and reducing it to the injectivity on functions and one-forms. Okay, but grant me this for the time being, so to keep on the general scheme of the proof, then I am exactly in the situation of the proposition. I have arranged the second right-hand side to be holomorphic, this vanishing on the boundary, so by the proposition, this guy here must be holomorphic. So now by the proposition, the solution of that transport equation is holomorphic with zero with zero degree zero term. Okay, but now if you just look at what this means, this is exactly saying that the Fourier coefficients of the U, which are below M, are all zero. Yes, let me write it down, see if I got them right. So, what this is saying, sorry? No, because this is holomorphic, so therefore Ru is holomorphic. So maybe there's one more step, so Ru is holomorphic. And if Ru is holomorphic, sorry? Yeah, so this is a holomorphic, so therefore Ru is e to the minus w times something holomorphic, then Ru is holomorphic. And remember what R is doing, is multiplying, is shifting everything up by M. So what this means is, if you look at the Fourier coefficients in detail, this means that, so in fact, not only holomorphic, but with zero Fourier coefficients. So holomorphic plus zero Fourier coefficients, but certainly enough to get a finite polynomial. But, you know, we get everything here. Plus that, and this implies that the UKs are all zero for k's below minus M. Minus M. Yeah? And that's it. Because now you do a similar argument going up with an anti-holomorphic integrating factor. So. And then you kill. You keep. No. So you want to vanish from minus M to down. Yes. That's what we want. We want to have degree M minus 1. Yeah. Okay. Okay, that's the idea. Yeah, and so I guess you don't need me to write. So this will do. Yeah, so it's an analogous argument going, taking care of the top bit of the U. Yeah, so it's a little bit crazy. Yeah? You attenuate and then you somehow gauge it away, and okay. So this is the scheme. Of course, I need to convince you that something like this is true. I will do it sort of immediately, and I also need to explain a little bit what is the natural choice of that R and A. So maybe I'll do that first. So let me try to show you that it's a very natural choice of RNA in this case. And at the same time, I will do something that maybe I should have done a while ago, but so choice of R and A. Okay, so we are working with a disk. This is a disk, yeah? It's a compact, simple Riemannian manifold, it's a disk. So I can take global isothermal coordinates in the disk. So I take global isothermal coordinates. So in this case, my metric is, let's write it like this. To 2 lambda dx squared plus dy squared, and if you write a metric like that, you can write explicitly what the geodesic vector field is. You can write this as e to the minus lambda cos theta d over dx. Let me write down the formula and then I explain what theta is, but I guess you can guess what it is. Okay, that's the formula for x, and I need to close one parenthesis. there. And okay, so what I have here is I have sort of coordinates x, y, theta are coordinates in the unit circle bundle, in which theta is the angle between a vector v and d over dx. Okay, or if you like the vector v, you know, you write it as cos theta sine theta. It's a unit vector now in that case. Okay, so in these coordinates, which are kind of very natural, so it's just, if you're on a disk, it's just x, y, and then in the sort of fiber direction, you get an angle theta for each fiber. Right, so this is the sort of, if you like, the curvy bit. Yeah? So if you were in a flat situation, you would have here lambda equal to zero, you wouldn't see this vertical derivative. Yeah? But if you have an arbitrary simple surface, you have this additional stuff here. Okay. Now that's dx, and the choice of r is very natural. I mean, so since you have now these global coordinates, the r is the most natural thing you can think of is e to the I m theta. That's clearly an omega m and has the right properties with respect to v, because v in these coordinates is just d over d theta. And I mean, these coordinates, I mean, the Fourier analysis is just usual Fourier analysis in the variable theta. That's what we're doing. Okay? And now you can compute what r inverse xr is with a negative sign. And you do a calculation, and it comes out to be this, Im minus d lambda over dy dx. You can write it in two ways, sort of depending on the, have to be, so let me write two sort of expressions on the identification. So this is, okay, so let me write it in detail and then I will explain. So remember, the connection has to be a something of degree one. Yeah? So this is, what you get formally in SM. If you were this to, if you were to convert this into an actual connection, this is what you get. Yeah? Because the coefficients here, the sort of, you know, e to the lambda cos theta and e to the lambda sine theta, sort of, you have to put them or take them away, depending on whether you write this as an actual connection in a disk, or if you restrict it to a unit tangent bundle. So whatever way you do it. So this is the A. In fact, this A is essentially M times Levi-Civita. So if you compute the curvature of this A, you will get M times the Gaussian curvature. So this is essentially M times Levi-Civita. So in a sophisticated language, what we are doing is, you know, the Levi-Civita lives on the tangent bundle, or if you like, on the cotangent bundle. We are taking here powers of the canonical line bundle and putting the Levi-Civita connection there, which essentially amounts, since everything is trivial here because you're working on a disk, multiplying by M. And this is the one that we are gauging away with the holomorphic integrating factors. Yeah? But this is the one that does the trick of shifting things to a holomorphic. Yeah? So you kind of move the ladder up by shifting it with this. You pay the price of introducing a connection, but then fortunately you can get away with it by moving it away with holomorphic integrating factor. So that's the idea. The bundle of symmetric bundles, no. What do you mean the bundle of symmetric? This is an infinite dimensional space. What do you mean? It's like the bundle of forms. What do you mean? Yes. Yes. Yes, you can put a holomorphic structure there, yes.
And then have
not exactly. I mean, no, I don't. Yeah. Yes. Yes. So I mean, yeah, but I'm not using at all in here the holomorphic structure on the line bundle, if that's what you're asking. I'm not using that. I mean, what you're saying is it's true. If you have a connection, it induces a holomorphic structure. It's a D-bar operator. We are not using that because that is in the other direction. That's in the direction of the base. I haven't used that. I'm here somehow using the holomorphicity comes somehow in the fiber. There's going to be a holomorphicity in the other direction if once I finish this, but. Yeah, so basically what the opening phrase of what you said is correct, but I'm not using, I think, the holomorphicity, the holomorphic structure there, or at least, I mean, that's not what we're doing. Yeah, because we're gauging this guy away with the omega. With the omega here. Which is holomorphic in the fiber direction. Now, if you ask me, do I really understand this proof? And the answer is no, probably. I still don't know exactly why it works completely. Okay, so let me convince you about the proposition that is on the board there. That's the last thing that I need to prove, I think. Okay, great. So for that. Right, so, okay, so it's again dealing with the bracket of the geodesic vector field with a Hilbert transform. So let me call W identity plus IH U, where U is that function there, with a minus. And what we are trying to show is that that this omega is actually equal to zero, and we are trying to show that in fact, yeah, no, that's what we're trying to show. So we go so if you remember, this equal to u naught meant that u was holomorphic. If in addition you prove that is equal to zero, you prove that both claims, that u is holomorphic and u zero is equal to zero. Right, so then I apply x to this. I apply x, and so here is where the bracket is going to come in. Okay, so the first bit is just xu minus identity x. Okay, so that's xu minus I, and the bracket was hx was on a function u, it was x perp u naught, x perp u naught. So that's h xu minus x perp u naught minus x perp u naught. Okay, and now you collect what you know about xu, so xu is minus f there, and it's minus f there, so therefore this becomes minus identity minus I h f, and then you get the other bit, which is plus I x perp u naught plus I x perp u not. Now, the F is holomorphic. I am assuming that the F is holomorphic. So if the F is holomorphic, then this becomes exactly F naught. this becomes minus f naught plus I x perp u naught plus I x perp u naught. And that's great, because the way it comes up here is being set up exactly to do the kind of things we want, because what I have here is a function of degree 0, a function of degree 1, and a function of degree 0. Yeah? So xw equals something of degree 0 plus degree 1. And about w, I also know that w on the boundary of Sm is equal to 0. Yeah? Because if u vanishes on the boundary, then since this is fiberwise, x orthogonal to u0 has degree 1 and minus 1. Yeah, sorry. Leaves equal. When I say degree 1, I mean, okay, to be completely precise, okay, sorry. Degree 0, 1, and minus 1. But that's all you need to have information about this, because this is saying that the x-ray transform of this is 0. But we know what happens when this happens. Yeah, because we know injectivity on 0 functions and 1 forms. Yeah, that has been proved. I mean, we've been using it all the time. So if you like, I mean, this proof kind of builds up, you see? You have injectivity, it's like a ladder. You know injectivity in functions and one forms, and then it kind of builds up. Yeah. So all you need here is injectivity in functions and one forms, and surjectivity on functions of the adjoint. And then the whole sort of machinery cranks up, and it takes care of all the tensors. This is somehow what's happening. Anyway, so this is of the form, I mean, function plus one form, basically. Okay, so that's of the form function plus one form, and I mean, there are a few more details, but I hope you can, there's no need for me to say more. I mean, from this you get everything you want, so. Few easy details imply using injectivity on 0 forms and S injectivity on 1 forms. Yeah, because there's some kernel, there's some exact things, but I mean it's very easy to deal with that. Implies omega equal to 0. So let me spare you the detail. I mean there isn't much there. Okay, so that's the tensor tomography thing. Okay, so I think I'd like to then finish talking a little bit about the closed case, whatever I have time, but at least I'm trying to tell you something that is non-trivial there, which is really very different from this. Just before I move into that, does anyone wish to ask any question about this? Or no? You're all convinced? Okay. I mean, it is counterintuitive, yeah? I mean, going to the attenuated, from the unattenuated to the attenuated one, and then disattenuating again. Which previous result? For the attenuated case?
Yeah.
I mean, okay, so you could go along that line, but remember that what ends up being here is not something of the form, a function plus a one form. I end up having here something holomorphic, which has some degree, which is not, you know, 0, 1. That would be one answer. You see what I mean? So what I did all the previous lecture was to prove in the attenuated case injectivity for functions and one forms. So I cannot use that sort of directly for this one. But there are ways of reducing it to that. So our sort of original proof went through going in that way. And in fact, this idea, combined with what I did before, will solve the whole thing. So when you have For systems, you put here a connection, you put here a Higgs field, and you put here something of degree m, the u comes up always of degree m minus 1. So at the end of the day, you sort of pull, if you pull the right place, everything are knots. So yeah, what you're saying is, you know, comes very close, but remember that what I actually did prove, it was just when the f was 0 and 1. Okay, so I'd like to talk a little bit about the closed case, and in particular about what I called in lecture 1 transpiring connections. Okay, so the setting here will be a closed surface now, closed orientable surface. Okay, and let's begin now. So I mean, I can do all this discussion, it's already interesting there, but I mean, in M cross C2, but let me begin just a little bit with CN and then I'll specialize. I take a trivial bundle and I consider a unitary connection. Okay, so the definition that I gave was something like this. A is transparent if the parallel transport along every closed geodesic is the identity. Okay. So the analog of this would be, in the case of manifolds with boundary, that the analog of that would be that the scattering data is the identity. Okay? And then, you know, the question would be, do you have ghosts in this case? Namely, if this happens, is the connection gauge equivalent to a trivial connection? Yeah, that would be the sort of key question here. So the question that one would like to ask. So the basic question is, trivial connection. Yeah, by the trivial connection I mean A equals to 0. Yeah? In the case of manifolds with boundary, the question would be, you know, you give an A and you ask, if this is an identity, must A be gauge equivalent to a trivial connection? Yeah, with a function bounding on the boundary, and we saw yes. So in this case of manifolds with boundary, I would say here that there are no ghosts. This is more or less, you can reinterpret the result in lecture 1 about this, seeing that there are no ghosts. Now, it turns out, I mean, maybe I can anticipate the goal of the last little bit, is to explain that in fact in the closed case there are ghosts. Quite a few, and they have a very beautiful structure, and this is actually the problem that I started looking at sort of originally. Yeah, and then I sort of drift into that one, because I wanted to understand the difference between the closed case and the case of manifolds with boundary, basically. Just before I move further, let me mention immediately, because I think one should always give the first sort of non-trivial thing quickly, and then move to a more technical thing, is that you can play the following game, which is not at all unrelated to what we did before, but so you take the tangent bundle of your surface, and you know, tangent bundle has Levi-Civita connection. Yeah? And the Levi-Civita connection on the tangent bundle is transparent, because if you have a closed geodesic, you know, just by definition of closed geodesic, gamma dot is a parallel vector, so you come back to the identity in this direction. And if you take a normal vector and your surface is orientable, you come back exactly where you started, because parallel transport is isometric. So Levi-Civita is transparent connection on the surface. Two-dimensional. All the discussion in the course is two-dimensional. Yes, that's right. So if in high dimensions you wrote, but in dimension two, it is transparent. Okay? Now, of course, what happens here is that this bundle is not trivial. Tangent bundle is not trivial. Okay? So this would be, you know, an example of a transparent connection on a line bundle. Sorry? You need orientability. My surface is orientable. Orientable, yes. So, right. So, you do that, but of course you can do exactly the same thing on the cotangent bundle. You have a transparent connection here, also given by Levi-Civita. It's exactly the same, it becomes a transparent connection by the same argument. Now you take the sum of this, and what happens is that this bundle becomes trivial now. Yeah, because this has, you know, one churn class and this has the opposite churn class, so when you add them up, they become zero. So you can trivialize this bundle. And in this way, you can put a connection in the trivial bundle, M cross C2, which is transparent, and which is not gauge equivalent to the trivial connection, because the curvature of this is essentially the curvature of the surface. It has two entries. I mean, it's essentially sort of IK minus IK. And then, you know, you sort of looked at this example, this was the first thing that I saw, I mean, and you say, oh, well, but then I have a lot, because, you know, I have a tangent bundle, I can start taking tensor powers, which is amounts to multiply by n, yeah, and positive tensor powers here, negative tensor powers here, I have a whole discrete spectrum of connections which are transparent, kind of quantized, essentially. So all of a sudden I have, you know, lots of transparent connections which do not arise here. And so for quite a while I was surprised, I mean, about this, and I thought that this, since they were so canonical, were probably the only ones, at least in negative curvature. So we'll try to convince you that in fact they are not the only ones. There's a huge number more having to do with the holomorphic structure of the surface itself, not the fiber, but with the surface itself. Yes? When I trivialize? Right. Did you hear me the word holomorphic? Right. So, holomorphically this is not true. I mean, this is unitarily. I'm not so sure. The spin of, what's the churn class of the spin of bundle? About what connection do you put? Okay, these are essentially all, there is a theorem that one can prove that if you have a transparent connection, then the churn class is divisible by 2 minus 2 times the gene, by the Euler characteristic of the surface. So if you were to take a spinor bundle like a square root of a tangent bundle or something like that, yeah, that's what I usually think of spinors, because it's square root. Yeah, that one's not transparent, cannot be. Comes very close, but it's not quite. Maybe flips the vector by minus something. Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's a long story somehow. Right. So, now, there's one thing I should perhaps do now, a little bit more technical, just before I move on. And this is to talk about the Lipschitz theorem, which Timo mentioned, I think I ought to mention here, which at some point it comes into play. So basically, if you have a unitary connection, you have a cocycle, what's called a cocycle defined over the geodesic flow. So what is this cocycle? The cocycle is a map, you know, it's just basically a package of all the transport equation into a unitary group, in which you define C by saying that the derivative of T with respect to T plus A along the geodesic flow times C is equal to zero, but then you start at the identity. So basically what I'm doing is, you know, you pick your XV on your manifold, and then you follow the unique geodesic, yeah, and you do the parallel transport starting at that point at the identity. Okay, and that gives you a smooth map from SM cosine to a unitary group. It has to go into a unitary group because this is skew Hermitian. This is what is called a cocycle in dynamical systems. The cocycle properties comes essentially from the uniqueness of the solutions to the differential equation, to a linear differential equation. I'll just write down the cocycle property just for completeness. Cocycle means that if you start at xv and you go time t plus s, it's the same thing as, you know, going time t and then going time s, basically. So you write that properly as for all ts and for all xv in s. Okay, so abstractly, this is how you define a cocycle with values in the unitary group. The product here is in the group. So the Lisi theorem is a theorem about cocycles in general, not necessarily coming from a connection like this, but for an arbitrary dynamical system. The condition of being transparent that we have, simply means that the cocycle is the identity every time that you move along a closed geodesic. So if you have a periodic orbit of the geodesic flow, what we are saying is that the cocycle is the cocycle at time t is the identity. Yeah? So this is what is called the periodic orbit of structure. What the Lipschitz term tells you is there is a U solving the transport equation if you have something transparent in the Anosov case. Okay, so to do that, state that in a tidy way, you introduce a sort of little definition. This is mainly to sort of also to connect with something that Alex asked. You say that the cocycle C is cohomologically trivial if there exists a U. I'll comment in a minute on the differentiability of this U. If there exists a U such that the cocycle at xvt can be written as U at phi t xv times u inverse of x. That's the way you say a cocycle is cohomologically trivial. If the cocycle satisfies the transparent condition of being the identity, if the cocycle is cohomologically trivial, then it clearly satisfies the condition, because if you move along a periodic orbit of the geodesic flow, this becomes xv and this matrix becomes identity. So trivially, somehow, cohomologically trivial, implies transparent. Now the Lipschitz theorem says that if the geodesic flow is Anosov, then transparent implies cohomologically trivial. And moreover, with U smooth, if A is smooth. So it's kind of dreamland. So basically, you know, in order to have a cohomologically trivial cocycle, you have to have the periodic orbit obstruction satisfied. And the Lipschitz theorem tells you that this is all you need. And it's fantastic because the U comes smooth. Lipschitz himself proved this, so the historical thing here is Lipschitz proved this in the 70s. Just getting new Lipschitz, basically. Maybe even C1. But then, Nitika and Torok in 98 proves infinity U. And this is completely general stuff for anosov flows. It doesn't have to be for the geodesic flow. So, if you have then a transparent connection, you have that U coming from the Lipschitz theorem, which is a kind of abstract thing, sort of dynamical argument, very beautiful. I could give you references for that if you want. But once you have the U doing this, if you differentiate this respect to T and you set T equal to zero, you arrive at the transport equation. What else? Yeah? So this is the integrated version of the transport equation, basically. So if you differentiate you just use the definition of C. If you differentiate respect to T, this was minus AC, T equals 0, C is the identity, and this becomes. Okay, so in a way, really, you know, one can think of this in two ways. So the anosov condition, at one point that it crucially comes, is via the Lipschitz theorem to say that something transparent gives you something cohomologically trivial. But now you can say, well, I could try to understand in general cohomologically trivial connections. Yeah, I already know that if they come from the anosov and the Lipschitz theorem, I will get them. Yeah? So now it makes a lot of sense to think of, you know, what are the cohomologically trivial connections? So. Okay, for the abelian case, maybe I should say this kind of quickly because otherwise I won't be able to explain what I want to explain. In the abelian case of n equals to 1, in which the connection is I theta, you can show that in the anosov case there are none. There are no ghosts in the abelian case. It's easy to see that the form theta must be closed. If A is transparent. This is equivalent, more or less, this is more or less equivalent precisely to, even though it's not quite the same, but you can kind of reduce it to the transport equation in which the second factor is a one-fold, basically. There's some bit of topology here, but it's not too difficult. And this was dealt by Guillemin and Kasdan. For surfaces in the 80s and negative curvature, and then by Dyubikov and Sharafutdinov, and maybe I should also mention Krog and Sharafutdinov, and the order was this for negative curvature, and this Dyubikov and Sharafutdinov for arbitrary anosov. So in the you know, dimension n equals to 1, there are really no ghosts whatsoever. Right, so if you go and think a little bit for a while, and this is what I did, and you try to see, you know, how the Lewicz-Witte connection fits into this, you can try to go and check that the Lewicz-Witte connection fits into this, where the function u becomes, depending on how many powers of the tangent bundle you take, has degree either 1, 2, 3, or 4. Which is natural. Okay, so then let me explain to you how one can tackle the general issue. So suppose now, okay, we are presented with this sort of panorama. Yeah? We have understood, even though I went very quickly here, but I mean, it sort of boils down to sort of thing that we have discussed. In the abelian case, there are no ghosts. Then you go to sort of higher rank vector bundles, C2 or higher, and then you start having all these little Civita connections, and then, you know, you would like to now deal with the question, well, are there more stuff there? How do you deal with that? So this would be one way to proceed. So, how can we get more? Well, you could say, okay, so I'm going to make my life very, very simple and look at the simplest non-trivial case. Yeah, so the simplest non-trivial case would be, you know, a surface n cross U2, and I'm going to make my life even simpler and consider the group not just U2, but SU2. Yeah, even better, special unitary group, where I can do the same thing, yeah? So in this case, you know, the connections that I'm looking for are taking values in the Lie algebra of SU2, which are matrices of this form. So ITA minus A bar minus IT, where T is a real number and A is a complex number. Okay. Yeah, so I put the additional assumption of having trace zero to make my life even better. And after all, SU2 is, you know, would you agree with me, Alex, the most important group in physics? Yes. No? Well, the first non-trivial important. Okay. I see it as the simplest non-trivial case in my setting. Yes. Okay. Right. So then I begin in a very humble way. I say, well, I would like to see if I construct just something of degree one. Yeah? A U that decomposes as U minus 1 and U1 in my Fourier analysis, taking values in U2 such that A defined by XU, U inverse, defines a connection. Defines a connection. This is what you need, yeah? To construct at least a cohomologically trivial. If you have a cohomologically trivial, solving the transport equation, much better, yeah? So it's like you turn the tables around, yeah? So you sort of, you know, begin with a U and see what kind of, when you can get an A. And it's easy to see how you can get an A. You would like, ideally, the A to have degree 1, to have all the elements in minus 1 and 1. Okay? So let's see when that happens. And to deal with that, we now introduce, or remind you about this, operators of Telemann and Kassian, the eta plus and eta minus, that I mentioned yesterday. So now you say, well, okay, I decompose my geodesic flow as eta plus minus eta plus eta minus. Let me remind you about these guys. And then you say, well, let's compute this. It shouldn't be too bad if it has that form. Let's compute XU. So XU times U inverse. Now, these are unitary matrices, so XU is the same as, now the inverse is the same as the conjugate transpose. Okay? So XU, well, let's apply eta. So I have eta plus U1 plus eta minus U1 plus eta plus U minus plus eta minus U minus times U minus 1 star plus U1 star. Now this is a moment I'm proud of. Now you say, this has degree 2. This has degree 0. This has degree 0, and this has degree minus 2. This guy, since I'm taking conjugate transpose, this one has degree 1, and this has degree minus 1. Yeah? And I would like this to have nothing in degree 3, or minus 3. So that means that the condition you need is this that has degree 2 times that has to be 0. Yeah, so this would be the degree 3 thing. And the other one that has degree minus 3 is this one and that. Okay? So if I have these two conditions, what comes out here is a connection. Because anything that remains here, which is some stuff that I don't know, but it has degree minus 1 and 1. Right? So what do these things mean? What do they mean? Well, in fact, two have popped up there, but I only need one, because one implies the other. So it ends up being only just one condition, so let me quickly explain that. So I'm looking for a unitary matrix, so unitary means, of course, that U times U star is the identity. So again, if you decompose this at U1 minus 1, if this is the identity, there are some things that have to vanish. So so this will have degree minus 1, so the U minus 1, U1 star has to be 0, and also the this has degree 1, so this times 2 will have degree 2, so the U1, U minus 1 star have to vanish. Sorry? Not quite. Oh yeah, if you transpose, yeah. Yeah, okay. Okay, so for example, what this means is that I can rewrite, let's say, the second condition. If you apply this, so if you apply eta minus to U minus U1 star, this is of course 0, so you get eta minus U minus 1, U1 star, plus U minus, eta minus, U1 star. So this being 0 is the same thing as this being 0. Okay. And now once you have this one, you can get this, the top one, for example, just by conjugating and taking transpose. Because when you conjugate the eta minus, you get the eta plus just by definition. So what I'm saying is that at the end of the day, there's only really only one condition, and I'm going to pick the one that I think suits me if I didn't get dizzy with all that, as the one that kind of suits me for some reason, or just simply by historical reasons, is I'm going to pick that one equal to 0. So really what we want is to ensure this. Now again, still the question remains, what does it mean? But at least with this just one thing to look at. And this is what it means. So you see, because of these conditions, I can define a line bundle L given by the kernel of U minus 1, which is the same thing as the image of U1 star. You see? So I am assuming that this U1 and U minus 1 are non-zero, yeah, otherwise. Okay? So the fact that the product of these two is equal to 0 means that the rank of, so it's a 2x2 matrices, the rank of this has to be 1. Yeah? So, and clearly the image of U1 sits inside the kernel of U minus 1. So they end up being the same thing. So these conditions define this line bundle. And it's actually a line bundle over M, because you see, these are elements in U minus 1, or in U1. So locally, for example, let's just, for example, U minus 1 will be of the form a function times e to the minus I theta, basically. Yeah? So if I'm looking for the image of this, as an endomorphism in C2, the e to the I theta doesn't matter, you're multiplying it by a complex number. Yeah? So this line bundle becomes now a line bundle on X. That depends only on X, so it's really a line bundle is a line bundle inside C2 over M. And what is the meaning of this? Well, the meaning of this is this. For example, if you take xi in C2, which is non-zero, and define a section S as U1 xi. Yeah, so remember, these U's are 2x2 matrices, the endomorphisms, yeah, of C2. So I can apply that to some fixed vector. So eta applied to S, so clearly this belongs to L, yeah, just by definition. And if you apply eta minus to this, this equation here, star, is saying that eta minus hits the kernel of U minus 1, so lands back in L again. Aha, but now, if you remember Adrian's question yesterday about what was eta minus, I told you that it was like a sort of debar operator. Well, this is saying that if you have a section in L, the debar of that lands in L. This is saying that the line bundle is holomorphic. Now holomorphic in the sense that you were mentioning, Alex, earlier. So, to convince you of this, and this is the last thing that one of the last things that I would like to do, is to write down a formula for eta minus in isothermal coordinates. So you can write down a formula for eta minus using the formula that I gave you for H, and I'm going to tell you what it does to an arbitrary section of omega m, or something, or a Fourier mode of degree m. So you can see that it's really a debar operator, essentially. Expression of eta. So it's not exactly debar, of course, but it's, you know, light debar. And it's enough like debar for me to be able to say that condition is really that L is a holomorphic line bundle. Okay, but now I have lots of holomorphic line bundles. They are in one-to-one correspondence with meromorphic functions on my Riemann surface. So it's a sort of one-to-one correspondence with meromorphic functions. So the idea now is this: you give yourself an arbitrary meromorphic function. You have this holomorphic line bundle. So the question is whether you can construct a U, so the question is now, does there exist, so given L, does there exist a U which splits as U1, U minus, from SM into SU2, such that L is the kernel of U minus 1? If I construct such a U, then the A will be a connection, and it will be a cohomologically trivial connection, and therefore it will be transparent. And it will have a huge supply. For every meromorphic function, I will have one of these. Because the answer to this question is yes, as I'm going to try to convince you in the last few minutes. Yeah? You see the logic, yeah? So the logic is, you know, I was trying to sort of discover how to construct homologically trivial connections in a very simple-minded way by imposing this trivial degree 1, and then somehow this condition surfaced. And I was able to reinterpret that condition as some line bundle being holomorphic, okay? And somehow I say, oh great, on a Riemann surface I had tons of holomorphic line bundles. So if I can now begin with one of those and I can come up with a U satisfying this, then my A will be a connection. And then I will have as many transparent connections as meromorphic functions on a Riemann surface, but I have tons of those. In fact, the Levi-Civita connections correspond to the case in which these bundles are trivial. They're kind of like the factors of C2, basically, in some suitable coordinates. Okay, and to convince you that this is true, the best way is to do this, which I also like very much, because when I first realized this, I was kind of very happy, because no one told me about this. It's elementary, but if you've never seen it before, it's kind of nice. It is, you know, there are lots of ways to think about meromorphic functions, but here's another one. Suppose you look at a function now from M into SU2, in which what you do is this. You don't hit all SU2, but you hit just the two sphere inside SU2, which is given by those matrices with determinant 1. So namely the two sphere given by matrices with determinant 1. So IT A minus A minus IT. Okay, so this is essentially saying that you are hitting the matrices which are which satisfy the property, if I call this G, satisfy the property G squared equals minus the identity. The holomorphic structure, essentially. Because if you have determinant 1 and has trace 0, the square has to be the identity. So therefore, the matrices you hit here have eigenvalue plus or minus I. Yeah? So if you have a line bundle L, you can declare this to be the eigenspace I of F, and then the orthogonal complement in the sort of Hermitian inner product will give you the minus I subspace. So whenever you have a line bundle, you can define a function like this, and conversely, if you have a function like this, it gives you a line bundle L by looking at the I eigenspace. Now, that F, so there's a one correspondence between this and line bundles, like this, and holomorphic here means that the F satisfies the following PDE. Let me just put it in the right way, I think it's... the F. So that's another way of saying that a function is holomorphic. So a meromorphic function is a function from the Riemann surface into the Riemann sphere, yeah, which is holomorphic with the holomorphic structures. So if I look at it in this way, parameterizing the two sphere in this form, this is the property of being holomorphic, which you can see this as a, precisely as the Cauchy-Riemann equations, because on the two sphere you can define a complex structure J mapping a vector X into XG in terms of matrices. So this equation here just says that DF interacts with the complex structure on the surface, E sort of commuting this, which is exactly the Cauchy-Riemann equations. Cauchy-Riemann equations with two complex manifolds is a map that intertwines the J's. So it's a nice exercise to figure out that all these things are equivalent. But, okay. So once you have done that, then your U comes from a sort of kind of exercise in linear algebra. I can write now a formula for U, which is great. So here is the U. The U is cos theta times the identity plus sine theta times f of x. That U will do the trick. This is a unitary matrix. It's a matrix in SU2. It's a path in SU2, yeah, essentially starting with some tangent vector in the Lie algebra. Yes? On the final direction. And this will do the trick locally. And then you go about showing that these things can be glued on the entire surface to produce a globally defined function U. So for every meromorphic function, we'll give you a cohomologically trivial connection. Connection of degree 1. Sorry, with U of degree 1. And this is general, it's not just for the Nusselt case. So for example, what I'm telling you is, now you can begin with a torus, take what's your favorite meromorphic function? Mine is the Weierstrass function, yeah? I mean, has to be, for example, on the torus. So you take the Weierstrass function, and the Weierstrass function has some associated line bundle, and you go through this procedure. In this case, it will be global, because in the torus things are kind of global. We can lift it to R2, and this will be your U, And if you do the calculation, being x of u inverse, that will give you a connection that is cohomologically trivial. So Tim asked me whether I could say things on the torus, and I could, but I mean, I couldn't give a convincing answer then. And you can do it on the two-sphere. You do it on the two-sphere, and for every monomorphic function on the two-sphere, you get a transparent connection. You unravel in the plane, and then you get Novikov's ghosts. These ones will give you Novikov ghosts. Because holomorphic functions, he did it coming from the sort of sigma models in physics, which are parameterized by holomorphic functions. And this is the same. Somehow. Okay, so I'll just finish saying that these are not the only ones. So these are just the only ones of degree 1. The amazing thing is you can actually classify them all. If you have something with degree k, there is an algebraic gadget called a Backlund transformation here. So these start to look like a solitons and integral systems at this stage. And you can classify them with a Backlund transformation. And I've done that in negative curvature, so I sort of prove that if you take negative curvature and you take the group SU2, I got a complete classification. Using a Backlund transformation, which is another story. Yeah, but it's quite a wonderful sort of universe there. This has only been done for SU2, as far as I know. No one has actually tackled more generally groups. I mean, SU2 and SO3 have been the only cases that I've dealt with. The connection is on C2, yeah. L plus S star is, yeah. So these line bundles are line bundles of C2. So this picture was in C2 somehow. So they're all in the trivial bundle, yes. I'm not convinced. Because I as I told you, there is a restriction on the Chern class of the bundle if it's going to have something transparent. So I think in the square root of the canonical line bundle, what happens is that it comes but with the opposite. It doesn't completely match. Okay. Well, in that case, I mean, you're changing the bundle for something that is unitarily equivalent to something. Oh, yeah, that's exactly that. Yes. Oh, okay. And in that case, yes, certainly. Okay. Then in that case, definitely, yes. Okay, I think that's a good place to stop. Okay. Sure.